Some say there are two ways to grow food. One way is with biology. The other way is with chemistry. If such is true, we simply must ask, which is best to eat? Food grown with biology or food grown with chemistry?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1106th edition of the Food Chain by here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Port Villa who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason.
Always a pleasure.
So now, which would you think is best to eat? Food grown with biology or foods grown with chemistry?
One word. Biology.
Go for biology. Okay, yes. Good. Well, folks, thinking back on the grandparents' farm near the little town of Belfry, Montana, not much went to waste on that little farm. 320 acres, everything fed everything. What was waste, you know, the crop residues, the garden waste, the kitchen scraps, all of that stuff was fed to the farm's animals. What was waste from the farm's animals was composted and fed to the organisms that lived in the farm's soil. And those organisms, of course, ate what was provided to them, and then what waste came from them went back to feed the crops. And so the circle was complete, and everybody was very happy on that farm. Living happily ever after, of course, until that day the grandparents sold their farm and moved into town. The new owners of the farm did not live on the land, and having no desire to maintain any of the farm's orchards or gardens, they plowed it fence post to fence post, planted government-subsidized sugar beets. The new farmers were not interested in recycling any waste. It's too much work for too little money. And so they inoculated the soil with NPK, sprayed the crops with pesticides, and collected their government money. What happened to the grandparents' farm is, in a nutshell, the story of the transformation of American agriculture from a business of biology to one of chemistry. And that transformation does lead us to ask today, which is best to eat? Foods grown in biological soils or foods grown in chemical soils? Now, that question is very close to which is best, foods from biology or foods from chemistry. But which is best could be... there's all kinds of variables in that, like equipment costs and so on and so on and so on. But which is best to eat is our question for the day, and we're curious to know what you think. Here to help us consider, we have Mr. and Mrs. Dirt. They're back on the radio with us, and we're so happy to have them. Been over a year since we last talked to David Montgomery and Ann Beakley, and so today we brought them back. Mostly, David said, last time David was on the air, he said, Michael, I've got a new book coming out, and we just got to do it. So here we are. We're doing this new book. What's the title, David?
Hey, Michael, it's great to be back. It's called Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. And it's about how farmers around the world have been restoring fertility, natural fertility, the biological version in the way you framed it, to their soils, and doing so remarkably fast and in ways that are actually more profitable for the farmers.
You call it a revolution?
Yeah, it's actually, if you look at, as we might get into, if you look at the sort of underlying principles that support the philosophy of modern agrochemical farming, what these farmers are doing is flipping those principles on their head, which is truly truly a revolutionary and transformative potential.
So, essentially, it's kind of going back to the original way, right?
Well, only partly, because what it turns out is that there's three principles that underlie this new style of regenerative agriculture, an agriculture that could build soil fertility, build the nutrient density of crops as a consequence of how we farm over time, sort of improve the system as we use the system. And two of those principles are actually very ancient ideas, crop rotations and using cover crops. But the third one, which is as essential as the other two for the system to really work over the long run and to work rapidly, is the idea of not disturbing the soil, so walking away from the plow.
Mm-hmm.
And combining those three is actually a fairly new way of doing things.
Well, also with us, Ann Beakley, the missus of Mr. and Mrs. Dirt. Ann, you're up in Seattle, and David is running around selling books, right?
Yeah, that's right. Hi, Michael.
Now, are you jealous that you didn't get to go and sell books, too?
Oh, David's not here, and he has no idea what's going on outside in the garden. Only I do.
Okay. There you go. Well, you know, and when we last talked, Ann, you talked about regenerating a garden, or actually turning it dirt into a garden, and you were pretty much using the same kinds of principles that David's talking about. Were you not?
Yeah, that's right. I would say the one difference is that I did not incorporate cover crops. I mean, a couple of times in the veg beds, but also a part of the garden is ornamental plants, trees, shrubs, mm-hmm. and flowers, and so on. So I didn't incorporate cover crops there. Instead, what I did is we talk about eating across the rainbow of fruits and vegetables. In my mind, I was mulching the soil sort of across the rainbow with lots of different kinds of organic matter, ranging from, you know, a brand new plucked, you know, green leaf to, you know, the tan to brown colors in a wood chip.
And so pretty much doing what David's talking about in his new revolution here.
Right.
Now, David, you're a geomorphologist, correct?
This is true.
Well, what the heck is that?
You're not the first person to ask me. It's a geomorphologist is that kind of a geologist who studies the evolution of the surface of the earth. So what shapes topography, how erosion works, how soils are built from rocks and integrated with biological matter to build fertile soils. It's the kind of the here and now of geology, the stuff that shapes the actual part of the world that we live on and walk around on and experience for ourselves.
Well, you know, my father-in-law is a geologist, and when I have the opportunity to travel with him, I always enjoy it because, he talks about the surface of the earth in geology terms, which is much different than my terms. I mean, he looks at things and considers the way they've been moving for long, long, long time. And you kind of do the same thing with respect to soil. You introduce the notion in Growing a Revolution that going back in history, in human history, which is relatively new history in terms of geology, we've made the same mistake over and over and over again as people when it comes to how we treat our soil.
Yes, that's one of the really nice things about being a geologist is that it takes a while to gain an appreciation for just how vast geologic time is and how short our own lifetimes are in that kind of a scale. But it does give you a fairly different perspective on things, and the soil is one of those things that a geological perspective really shifts your view when you adopt it. Because most people, you know, we look at the soil as something that's always there, we walk around on it, we might plant a tree in it, we might plow it, whatever. But we don't think of it as a system that can change over time, and yet it really is. If you think of what soil is, I like to think of it as the marriage of geology and biology. It's where the sort of the dead rocky core of the planet mingles with the living crust of the biological world that coats it. And the transfers across that frontier are really important. And it's a system wherein you can build soil over time, but just as you can build it, you can lose it. And what I found back looking through history through that kind of a lens is that farming practices, particularly those that relied on the plow, which is sort of an unusual villain in this long-term story of civilizations because it helped set the stage for the rise of civilizations, but it had the seeds within it of the decline of societies because the plow allows soil erosion, and soil to be stripped off faster than nature can form it. And what I learned by watching how Anne changed our yard and our garden was just how fast, if people apply ingenuity and some focus and effort, to the problem of rebuilding fertile soils, we can do it far faster than nature tends to do it.
And we're going to have to take a quick break when we do come back. I'd like to talk about what happens when we use the plow on the soil, both in terms of the structure of the soil, but also in terms of that biology, all of those little bugs, because last time we talked together, we talked about all of the little bugs in the soil and how the soil is really populated, kind of like China, filled with bugs. And what happens to those little bugs when we use the plow and forget to tend them? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're revisiting some good folks, people of the earth, people of the soil, Dr. and Mrs. Dirt, as it were. David Montgomery, who's a UW professor of geology and author of Growing a Revolution, and Ann Beakley, his wife and author of Dig to Grow. And you, right back.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, and thank you, Will Strickland. We are back, and we are talking soil with two people who know all about soil, David Montgomery and Ann Beakley, and you. We are at 831-479-1080. And before we went to the break, we were talking about the plow. And look, consider the plow for a moment. It did lead to civilization, did it not, David?
Yeah, it was a tool that really helped a small number of people grow a lot of food, which freed up labor for people to start doing other things than growing their own food. So it was one of those early innovations that really sort of helped launch society on the trajectory that ultimately led to where we are today, where, you know, only about 1% of Americans are actively farming and feed the rest of us who can do things like write books.
And boy, do we have plows. Oh, my goodness. Big, giant, huge gang plows that can – we plow up everything with our plows, right?
Yeah, we have had a long-running love affair with the plow dating back to pre-Roman times.
Yeah, and guys in their tractors, right? Romans probably loved their tractors, too, if they had them.
I'm sure they loved their oxen.
Well, okay, what happens when we plow the land? As we do, go out to the Midwest, we plow up everything. What happens to the soil when we plow?
Well, yeah, the basic problem is it disturbs the surface. I mean, it's intended to invert the soil. It actually provides a great weed control because it bats down what may be growing there. But at the same time, how many times have you gone around and looked at like the ground and under a native forest or in a grassland? How much bare, loose earth do you see? Not much. Nature tends to clothe herself in plants, and that those plants then grow and die and, you know, shed their roots, and that organic matter mingles with the soil, which makes it more fertile, which helps the plants grow, and you get an engine of fertility that essentially builds both the soil and the living matter that grows from it. And what the plow does is it disrupts that part of that cycle, and it leaves the ground bare and vulnerable to wind and rain between the time that you plow and churn it up and the time that your crop or the weeds, whichever comes in, actually grows back to cover the surface. And it turns out that that can lead to erosion happening a lot faster than the soil rebuilds, which means the longer you do it, the more you're degrading the soil.
And one of the things, of course, a plow does is that it breaks down the structure of the soil and the glue that holds those soil particles together. And when they're on their own, there isn't anything to hold them down. They can fly with the wind. But what about the biology? And B. Clay, you're the biologist. What happens to the biology of soil when we plow it up?
Well, you talked before the break, Michael, about all the bugs in the soil. And there are a lot of different life forms in the soil. There's one metric that you'll see over and over again if you open up just about any sort of gardening or farming book or something about the soil is the trillions and trillions of microorganisms in a teaspoon of soil. So imagine the numbers, you know, that are beneath, you know, a square foot or several hundred acres. The problem with the plow or in a garden setting, you know, a trowel or a shovel, which can also be pretty destructive, is that you are slicing and dicing up a lot of different life forms. And one in particular is the mycorrhizal fungi. So these are organisms that the fungi have these long thread-like parts of their body called hyphae. And one end of that hyphae is out foraging in the soil for minerals. Fungi can actually break down rock particles in the soil and capture the minerals, things like copper or zinc or iron, and they transport that mineral through their hyphae right to the root itself. Many mycorrhizal fungi live either on the root surface or actually inside of a root. And so what mycorrhizal fungi essentially are is a nutrient highway from, you know, the far reaches of the soil all the way back to the plant. They will bring critical minerals to the plant. So you slice and dice that up, it's like, you know, it's like an earthquake hitting, in that, imagine, you know, we all know in earthquake country that you get a big enough quake and gas lines and water lines and all of these really critical parts of our infrastructure bust up and break apart. And that is what disturbing the soil does relative to, you know, this one example of mycorrhizal fungi.
And that's just one example then.
Right, right. And bacteria, all, you know, things from smallest things like bacteria and even viruses all the way up to what are called sort of the macro forms of soil life, earthworms, beetles, things like that, they're getting physically smashed and destroyed, you know, when you really are digging up the soil and disturbing things.
So this is the way it was always until we discovered a new way of doing things. And so that's kind of what happened to the grandparents' farm, you know. They grew old, they sold their farm, moved to town, somebody else bought their farm, didn't live on the land, plowed it fence post to fence post, and instead of recycling and feeding, you know, the living critters that live on and underneath and within the farm, we started using nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium fertilizer that had been synthesized and made readily available. And now we're living happily ever after with that kind of agriculture. Where is that going to take us? David, you have five myths in growing a revolution. You know, we're told, myth number one, that this new form of industrial chemical agriculture is what feeds the world.
Yeah.
Isn't that a good deal?
Well, it's an interesting question to look at, because when you parse it, it's not quite true. you know, there's almost 3/4 of the world's farms are actually fairly small farms, less than a hectare or 2.5 acres in size, about the size of a typical city block. And like 80% of the world's farms are family farms. So the idea that large-scale industrialized agrochemical agriculture is feeding the world today isn't quite right. And even if you look at, say, North America, where much of our agriculture has moved that way, if you look at what most of it is being used for, a surprising amount is used for fodder for animals that are grown in confined feeding operations, or it's grown for biofuels. A minority share of it's actually grown to feed the public, and surprisingly little is exported to areas of the world where people are hungry. Most of our exports actually go to the developed world and are in the processed food and sort of chain in the developed world. So if you look at sort of who's really feeding the world today, it's not quite as clear-cut a picture as one tends to hear.
So it's a myth.
It's one of those things where I think that the it's a myth. The perception doesn't quite match up with the reality. And one of those other myths that are out there in that mix are that it's actually more efficient to grow food that way. But there was a National Research Council study back in 1989, this is not new news, that said that well-managed alternative farming systems, by which they mean sort of alternatives to large-scale industrialized agrochemical agriculture, that those alternative systems almost always use less pesticide, fertilizer, antibiotics, and diesel per unit of production than do conventional farms. In other words, they more efficiently transform those inputs into food.
Well, if that, I have an idea. I have something that might be a myth, but I'm not certain. I would say that chemical agriculture is easier than biological agriculture. And what would you say to that?
Well, you mean easier from the standpoint from the farmer's perspective?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd probably...
Well, just a minute. We have to take a break. And that means that you get a chance to consider that, as does David. Is chemical farming easier than biological farming? I think so. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, and we'll be right back. What do you think? 831-479 is the phone number. Which do you think is the best to eat? Foods grown in with biology or with chemistry?
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Back for more. Here we are. Michael Olson here with David Montgomery, author of Growing a Revolution. Lots of fun stuff in there. And B. Clay, his wife, and she, he, her husband, and is the author of Dig to Grow. One is a geologist. The other is a biologist. The geologist looks at soils or dirt, as it were, over time, and Anne looks in the dirt for the bugs that live there and make life possible. And so we're talking a little bit about the impact of modern agriculture on the way things go, and how we've turned away from biology and to accept chemistry. And I believe that biological systems are much more complex than chemical systems. Now, I'm going to throw that to my guest. I just think about what Thomas Jefferson said about what it takes to be a successful farmer. You have to be a mathematician. You have to know chemistry. You have to know biology. You have to know politics. You have to know everything to succeed as a farmer. But if you're just using chemicals, it's just, you measure the right amount of chemicals, and that's that. And, or am I wrong?
That's a great quote from Thomas Jefferson. I just wanted to clarify something real quick, Michael. Actually, the book that Dave and I co-authored before Revolution was called The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. And Dig to Grow, though, is very relevant because that is our website and also our Twitter handle.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Thank you for straightening me out there.
Sure, Dig, and it's the number 2, and then Grow. So, yeah, as to the question of chemistry versus biology and ease of those two things, I think in general, all things sort of being equal, relying on chemicals to grow plants is easier. And I think that it sort of depends also on the kind of farmer that somebody is. If you're looking at farming as, an industrial sort of factory widget kind of a process.
Which is how agriculture is looked at by most everybody around. Is
right.
it not?
Yeah, no, that's right. And so what you want to do is you want to develop a formula if you're churning out widgets. And so that formula is, plow the soil, get your seeds in, get your fertilizer in, wait for the pests to come, go back out to the fields, spray some stuff around, and then harvest. And so that's
And collect the government subsidies.
Yeah. Right. And so if you have a formula down for anything, it makes life, you know, it makes life simpler. If, on the other hand, you're looking at the biology of the soil and you're considering, okay, I know these plants are going to come into fruit in a week, and I know that that's about the time that such and such a pest shows up. Well, I'm going to be doing things way before that cycle and do things to boost my beneficials, either, you know, in the soil or on top of the ground somehow. So this is what has sort of overrun, I would say, not just agriculture, but also to some extent gardening. We tend to pick up these methods and practices and formalize them. You know, in the spring we do this, in the summer we do this, in the fall we do that. But if you're doing things more from a biological foundation, what it means is you've got to be out there in your, you know, on your farm or in your garden, looking around to see what's going on. And for example, I'll give you an example. We had, Seattle's a rainy place, except that last year we had a bumper crop of rain. Let's just put it that way, okay? And everybody's garden, ours included, plants are putting on monstrous growth. It's almost like you got to walk out the door with your pruners or your machete or something. And seriously, overnight, it's like something else is just taken over. So what I noticed, and this has never happened in the, you know, 15 years that we've had this garden, I had trees that were getting their leaves munched. And I'm like, what is eating these trees? I've never seen anything on them. And it's some, you know, some lousy moth laid its eggs there. Caterpillars emerged. These are not tent caterpillars. They're some other type. But a fair amount of predation is happening in the garden, and that's partly because these plants have put on so much growth. So it's like extra food in a way. All of our plants are going to be fine, but one of the things that can happen in an agricultural setting, especially with chemicals and over the over application of chemicals, I would say, especially nitrogen. Nitrogen makes a plant grow like gangbusters, so it puts all this biomass on, and that is setting the table for pests and pathogens to come and munch down these plants. So you have to be aware of, you know, seasonal differences, what's going on with pest and pathogen populations, probably what's going on with the farms around you. And all that stuff is just like what you said, you know, what Thomas Jefferson said. You've got to be looking at the whole environmental setting if you're going to be farming, you know, with biology in mind. And when you farm with chemicals more in mind, you can get away with, you know, not considering the whole environment, I would say. You can get away with that for a little while until, you know, soil...
Until something happens.
Yeah, soil becomes sick or, you know, something disastrous happens with your yield.
Well, David Montgomery, it seems like we're getting away with it. Are we not?
Well, what's interesting to me is to look at the question of what really made agrochemical-intensive agriculture attractive and successful when it was first really operationalized in the early to mid-20th century on large acreages in the developed world. And if you look at what happened is that, you know, in the 19th century, people discovered that if you add certain elements, particularly if you get nitrogen into the soil, whether it's coming from guano or later in the early 20th century from artificial synthetic nitrogen sources, or if you add a lot of phosphorus, as discovered in the middle of the 19th century, you can boost the growth of plants, like Anne was saying. And that really can have a big effect if your soil is already degraded. If you've burned through the natural fertility that's housed in the organic matter in the soil, you could think of organic matter as the batteries for soil fertility. If those batteries are drawn down, if you add a shot of sort of the key major elements that N, P, and K needed to support robust plant growth, you can get a good response on yield. And that's what made the opening the door to fertilizers in the 20th century so attractive, is that a lot of our soils in Western Europe and North America had been seriously degraded by centuries of plowing. But one of the things that happens when, so you can boost the yields, but we give in some ways conflated growth and health in how we look at the effects of farming practices on our crops.
And on those organisms that eat those crops, be they animals or be they people, right?
Yes. And there were people back in the 1930s who were arguing that there's a direct line from soil health to human health that ran through the health of our crops, the health of our livestock, and the nutritional qualities of the food that's produced by how we farm. And what they had were observations, sort of case studies that made their case.
Hold those. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about that guy, Sir Albert Howard, and his impact on agriculture. But I want to go back and ask, why should we change when this chemical business is so easy? Right back.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the South China Sea, January 1945.
In the South China Sea, we had weeks of weather that was either bad, worse, or worst. Sometimes it was so bad all you could do was tie yourself to a chair or in your rack and hold on. There was no way you could stand on deck. I remember looking out over the waves and seeing one of our sister tin cans do something that scared me out of my socks. That destroyer went completely airborne, like a fish jumping out of the water. I clearly remember seeing both its propellers spinning in the air. The sonar dome, which extends down from the bottom of the ship, completely cleared the surface of the water. I thought, if this is going on, we don't stand a chance.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Seems to me like there are a lot of people like David Montgomery, Alan Savory, Joel Salatin, preaching this notion that we have to go back in time and redo things. And a lot of these good folks, like David, in his book Growing a Revolution, point to this guy named Sir Albert Howard. What was it that he said?
Well, Sir Albert Howard had the insight that the connections between the life in the soil and the microorganisms in particular is what he focused on, but that the life in the soil really helped nourish plants. And so that one of the best ways to build fertility in soil was to feed the fungi. And how do you feed the fungi? It's with organic matter. So he really pioneered large-scale composting and the return of organic matter to the land as what he saw as the way to drive the engine that fuels the nature's recycling system that takes once living matter, that organic matter, and converts it back into the raw materials to support the growth of new life. And he saw that as the way to support healthy crops, and that was the way to a very effective way to manage pests and pathogens and to keep yields up, was to support the robustness and health of the crop rather than trying to kill all the pests and pathogens. And his views were sort of prescient. They are right in line with what much of the science of the succeeding 50 years came up with, but they didn't have an understanding of the mechanisms of how microbial life interfaces with plants and helps provide the nutrition to plants, helps keep them robust, provides them with the micronutrients they need and that we need to have in our food when we eat them, and how they tee up plant defense and help suppress pests. The understanding of how that all works came long after Howard was dead.
And as a biologist, makes a lot of sense, right? Even on an intuitive level, you feed the soil, you feed the organisms in the soil, and they feed the plants. But what about us? What impact, does all of this have on people and animals that eat the crops?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Michael, and we're on it. We explored this a little bit in the hidden half of nature. And it's long been known that mineral and vitamin deficiencies can affect a person's health. Take something like magnesium. Magnesium is an element that's involved in over 200, enzymatic reactions in our body. And we get magnesium in our diet, in fruits, vegetables, and probably a little bit too in some kinds of meat, and certainly in fish. So it stands to reason then that if the nutrient content of our food is different than it once was, that there will probably be some kind of health effects from this. And it's a hard problem to tease apart because there's a lot of factors that affect a person's health. But there's been studies that have documented nutrient declines in food over time. One study compared nutrient levels in foods with what's called the chemical composition of food book. This is a gold standard for that just lists nutrient levels in different foods. It's out of the UK, and there was a person who compared the 1940 edition of that book with later editions in early 1990s and 2002, and found that between 1978 and 1991, that copper, iron, and magnesium all experienced significant declines. These were averaged across all food groups, and just so, for example, copper declined by 20 to 97%.
Ooh!
Iron.
So this is huge.
Yeah, iron declined by 24 to 83%, and magnesium declined by up to 26%. And there's been subsequent studies done in the U.S. comparing various nutrient food databases to foods and have picked up similar declines. And so if you think about this, Michael, what is going on with modern agriculture is if you're disrupting all of this life in the soil that are functioning as nutrient highways between all of these minerals and nutrients in the soil and the plant itself, it means that many of these things are not making it into a plant's green body. And that means when we eat those plants, we are not getting those minerals. And likewise, our livestock is not getting those things.
So essentially, we're starving ourselves to death.
Well, yeah, and this is what's interesting.
Or it's at least starving ourselves into ill health.
Right. What's interesting is that for a long, long time, we have looked at health in terms of adequate calories. Are we all getting enough to eat? And we've pretty much solved that problem, at least in the developed world. We all get enough to eat, and some of us get
too much to eat
in terms of calories. There's really a sort of a hidden health effect in terms of what ought to be the levels of minerals, the micronutrients,
right,
the things that are in the soil. And that is a harder thing to see. It's a harder thing to talk about because we're so used to looking at food in terms of biomass and quantity and not used to looking at it in terms of quality. And another topic along those lines are phytochemicals. So these are not minerals or vitamins that are in plants. These are chemicals that are beneficial to human health. But there are no standards, for example, to say,
we're going to have to hold that right back. When we get back, what are we going to do? We have a revolution. Let's start a revolution right back.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, The other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy it'll make you blush. Pledge 2 local bucks each day. Get 2 others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Anne Biclay suggests, from studies done in London, I guess, that the nutrients that was once in our food is disappearing. Significant amounts of differences, up to 97%. Is that what you said?
It varies depending on what mineral you're looking at, but
sure.
copper was one, and there was up to the range was between 20% and 97% reduction in copper.
Wow.
Yeah, and this is averaged across all food groups.
Well, it seems as though we're starving ourselves to death. David?
Yeah.
Well, it's essentially a chronic malnutrition problem in terms of micronutrients. But you know, what I looked at in this new book, Growing a Revolution, was trying to visit farmers who had adopted a suite of practices that prioritized the cultivation of soil life and the beneficial soil life that can help us solve that problem. And I visited farmers in the developing world, developed world, looked for the general principles that underlie farmers who had successfully restored fertility to their soil. The question of what that does to the nutrient density of their food is something that's under active investigation, and Ann and I are starting to track that, but it's really sort of embryonic. But the simple practices are three mm-hmm. basic principles that flip the philosophy of conventional farming on its head. And it's not quite the simple organic versus conventional farming argument, but the practices are ditching the plow, covering up the soil with cover crops, and growing a diversity of crops, which is a 180-degree view from the conventional methods of plow-intensive, lots of fertilizers and agrochemicals.
Yes,
and
but David, that's the hard way of doing things. It takes intelligent people to be able to manage that holistic management where you have different kinds of crops, different seasons, everything's different all the time. What about that? You have one crop, you have 1,000 acres of one thing, and it's easy. How are you going to talk people into doing something that's difficult when it's...
It's actually, I don't think it's necessarily more difficult per se. It's harder to imagine what the practices are, but there's people who have laid a roadmap for how to do it. So there's good examples to follow. And to answer your question of how do you get people to do something that might require, you know, not necessarily more effort, but certainly more creativity and thinking about adapting general principles to their specific place, and that is they can be more profitable. Because if you use less agrochemicals to grow the same amount of food and you do it in less time, that's what you get with that suite of three practices of going to no-till or ditching the plow, using cover crops and growing a diversity of crops.
And maybe, just maybe, us city folk will start thinking about what's in our food and scratching our head a little bit and thinking, wow, maybe Michael Olson's third law of the food chain is right. Maybe cheap food isn't. And maybe that food from that farmer who's going the extra mile and using the extra brain power and doing the extra work really is better.
Hear, hear. I love your third law. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that we really all should be much more concerned with how our food is grown.
And is it possible?
I think it is, and I think we have models certainly out there. There's organic farmers, at least those that look after the health of their soil, that are showing us it's possible.
Ways to go. Well, yeah, David Montgomery, Growing a Revolution, and Anne Biclay, biologist and co-author, thank you both for joining us, and see you more. Next time you got something, let me know, because I like working with you two.
Sure thing, Michael. Yeah, thanks. Bye-bye. Very much. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.